Everyone, this is John.
This is Wes.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show 64, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. And like the name implies, we're going to talk about retro games, specifically one for the Nintendo 64 and a couple of other retro stuff. Kind of a peek back in time to October of 1999. And what a time to be alive it was.
Well, before we get into 99, we need to discuss now.
Okay.
We are all in the same fucking room.
We are in the same room, yes.
We're all here.
Yeah.
The band's back together.
Yeah.
Way God intended it.
Just huffing corona right now.
Yeah. We closed the door, so we're pretty much just hotboxing ourselves in with the corona.
Well, we'll get at least one of these in, and if the world continues to end, we might be remote again. We'll see. Right now, Central Florida is not particularly hard hit, but things can change in a hurry, can't they?
My brother-in-law got it.
Oh, great. Have you seen him?
I've not seen him. Okay.
Are you exposing us to yourself a bit?
Yeah, well, you know. Come here, give me a kiss. I did drop something off to her, my sister.
Uh-huh.
And she came outside and we talked through the driveway.
Okay. Just shouted at each other.
How's this doing? He got a fever and then that was it.
Well, good.
He feels fine. But he's, you know, still coronaed.
Yeah, you know, it's still very possible to pass it on, so it's good that he's being cautious.
Yeah, he's secluded himself to the upstairs, and everyone else has to stay downstairs.
Like a disfigured family member.
Exactly. They're lucky they don't have an attic.
That's where Hubert is.
Wait, in The Simpsons, it was Hugo.
Hugo, yes, thank you.
And they fed him fish heads. That episode is fucking brilliant.
Speaking of things we loved in the 90s.
Oh, that just made me think of the episode where they think Butters has come back from the dead.
Oh, yeah.
And they kill that lady and throws her downstairs and eats.
Yeah. She has some SpaghettiOs. So, looking back to October 1999, I got some movies as well as a handful of video games here that I think are going to be fun to talk about. And if you guys have anything else that you want to chime in with, because... I didn't notice anything noteworthy that stood out to me anyway in music, but I have a very narrow taste in music, and no real significant historical events that I noticed either. But again, if you guys got something, go ahead and jump in. We're gonna kick things off on October 1st of 1999 when the film Mystery Alaska was released in theaters.
I don't know this film.
This is a silly film.
I remember seeing this one. Gosh, yeah, it was basically about, like, all I remember was about was, like, small-town drama in this place, Mystery Alaska.
Yeah, the premise around it is Russell Crowe, who is an Australian man playing a Canadian in this movie. It's a small Canadian town, and their, like, local town hockey team is going to be playing a professional hockey team, and it's, like, sort of, like, around the preparations for that big game that's going to, like, give this town their big break and put them on the map and that kind of stuff and all the hijinks that ensue around that. But I think what stood out to me most about looking at this movie again was that it was directed by Jay Roach, who you might recognize as the director from the Austin Powers movies, as well as Meet the Parents, Meet the Fockers, and most recently, Bombshell. The movie about all of the disgusting things that happened at Fox News. Kind of an outlier, I think.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, did he... gosh, I don't want to get it wrong. I'll look it up, his filmography. I want to say he's the guy that did... was it The Big Short?
I don't know.
Oh.
I'll double check on that one. But I
had a hard time following that movie, but I did enjoy it. There was a lot that just would easily go over anybody's head.
There's a lot of inside baseball. I'll admit, I had to turn on subtitles. Ryan was probably like, "It was just so pedestrian."
I mean, I thought it was really well done. I just want to make sure that this is the same guy. But at any rate, go on. If you
want. Just the other movie that came out on October 1st that I think was worth mentioning: Three Kings, directed by David O. Russell. This is the one with. George Clooney, and they are these soldiers, and I think in Desert Storm, and they are going AWOL in order to pull off some sort of heist or robbery to, you know, strike it rich while they're in the military. A little bit less of a comedy than I think it was kind of pitched as, but David O. Russell, the director, you probably recognize that name from movies like The Fighter, or Silver Linings Playbook, or American Hustle most recently. He does a little bit... you know, not super highbrow stuff, but a little bit more than Jay Roach, that's for sure. So, let's move over to a video game. On the Game Boy Color, on October 5th, we got Mario Golf. This was developed by Camelot and published by Nintendo. And this was the companion version to the N64 Mario Golf game.
I was about to say, didn't N64 Golf already come out? Yep. Like, this is...
Yeah, also developed by Camelot. I think it came out a month or two before, but it is ranked number 11 on the official N64 rankings, determined scientifically. But yeah, this was...
Yeah, we used a protractor and everything.
Yeah, indeed. But this was, of course, the handheld version of that, so not as technically proficient, but had a lot of cool features, such as like creating your character at the beginning, sort of progressing through the story mode with this character that you're creating and improving as you go. Kind of brought these sort of RPG level up and stat management elements into the series. And there was some connectivity between the N64 and the Game Boy Color versions of these games, where you could import your character into the N64 version using the transfer pack for the N64. Yeah, so kind of a fun little connectivity thing there. You can get this 3DS game for $5 on the Virtual Console on 3DS, or you get a used cart for $15 if that's your jam. But yeah, not really too much to go into detail about this one, because we already talked a bit about Camelot when we talked about the N64 version, but yep, it exists. But on the 11th of October, we got our N64 game that we're going to highlight for this month. It is Jet Force Gemini.
Ooh, I always have fond memories of this, but at the same time, I could not tell you a damn thing about this game.
It's got a fun name to say, that's for sure.
Jet Force Gemini.
Jet Force Gemini, yeah.
So this one was developed and published by Rare, a name that a lot of people probably recognize on the N64. Also produced by Chris Stamper, one of the founders of Rare. It's a third-person shooter and was developed by the team that also did the Blast Corps game, which is the number...
I remember that game being pretty good.
Number nine ranked, yeah. N64 game.
That game definitely overachieved.
Yeah. So... Jet Force Gemini is a little bit, it's quite different in scope, but I think it stands out in the N64 library as being something that is pretty singular in its concept. It is a third-person shooter, and that's not really a genre that's well represented on the N64. It's very dominated by first-person shooters, because they were very much in vogue and Rare to this point. And 99 has probably the most high-profile first-person shooter on the system, and with Perfect Dark on the horizon, you know, those are like 1 and 1A for like the high-profile first-person shooter stuff. But for Jet Force Gemini, they went third-person. There is a swap between first and third-person mode, but what'll happen is when you press the R shoulder button, you enter a first-person mode where you become stationary, you can't move around, and you're pretty much just moving around your targeting reticle to, you know, shoot enemies that are above you. Because when you are when you're in the actual third-person exploration mode, you can, of course, still shoot, and you're using the Z trigger on the back of the controller to shoot. And you don't really have much control over... the sort of verticality, the y-axis of where you're aiming. You're pretty much aiming dead in front of you, and you know, you're moving with the analog stick, of course. D-pad is meaningless in this game. And you have a strafe. You can move side to side with the C buttons, and then your down C button is your duck, and up C is jump for some reason. But that's the direction they went. And just as a point of interest, A and B do nothing. They have no function in the game. But what you're doing is...
Do you know if there was any, by any chance, like rebinding features in the game? Or I don't know if you messed around with it.
A little bit. I didn't... There are some options to switch up the controls. I don't know how in-depth it goes, because I was just learning the game, so I didn't want to mess with the controls off the default too much. Yeah. But there are different control options. I'm just not sure that any of them allow you to use the A and B buttons. I think I don't know, maybe I'll do some I'll plug it in again and report back on the next retro show.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. It's sort of like you get one axis where you've got a really good range of motion on the shot. The other one, you kind of either need to strafe into it or have already lined up the shot in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. And the game is pretty forgiving in the damage that you're taking. So, you know, you're not too worried about taking too much incoming fire. So, what the game does is, you know, it doesn't really hit you with too many waves of enemies over and over again. It's not a pure, like, run-and-gun sort of action game. It does have these both platforming and sort of adventure, almost Metroid-esque elements to it. First of all, it doesn't have a map, and it could use one. But neither here nor there. We'll get to that in a minute. But you sort of access different parts of the game semi-non-linearly, and some of the parts that you're gated off from have certain requirements, like kill all the enemies in this area, find a red key card, then you can go into here. And you can move through the game in a different order as you would like in a previous playthrough. So it's not so much that, you know, you need to visit areas and then backtrack and go to other areas. There's not much of that. It's more of you can go in all these different directions in order to complete the game. So, and it does have some light platforming as well. As I mentioned, the up C button is your jump. It's a little bit awkward. I'm not sure why they wouldn't just map that to an A or B, but maybe that's an option in the adjusted controls. Overall, it feels pretty good. I think that the character has like a good weight to it. It doesn't feel like kind of floaty or like you're gliding around a little bit like it does sometimes feel in these older N64 games. You always feel like you have a pretty good control over your character. Aiming can be a bit of a hassle. Using the strafe to sort of like lead yourself into a shot is really useful. There is limited ammo in the game, but most of the areas that I went to always had like an ammo pack that you could pick up right near the exit, so you're kind of starting fresh in each spot that you went into. Oh, there are also like little side objectives in a lot of the areas, and they mostly revolve around like in the forest area that's in the beginning of the game, these little koala dudes, and they're hidden throughout the level, and they're kind of like these hostages, and you have to kill the enemies around them in order to like have them escape to safety, and in order to access certain parts of the game, you need to free them. So in order to see the entire thing, if you want to 100% the game, you have to find all these things and free them. But you know, the lack of a map or any sort of like radar system makes it difficult. Just by way of example, the first time I encountered these creatures in the first area that they were in, I found one out of six, and they at least tell you like, hey, there's six here, but I had no idea where to look for the rest of them because I thought that it was a pretty straightforward area. I didn't really see a whole lot of branching paths. So it does have co-op, which is pretty cool, but it's not like a full two-player split-screen kind of co-op. It's more like you have single player, and the second player with another controller just has like a little target reticle on the screen rather than a playable character. Which, you know, in a game like this that has a sort of adventure-y elements, it would have been really cool to have like a split screen so you kind of diverge and maybe like flank some enemies or take different routes.
Well, it seems like you have a little mobile sentry that kind of travels around with you. So yeah. I guess it would kind of make sense that would be the second player.
Yeah, that's the second player sort of icon. But like there's three different playable characters, so it's not like you would have to be tied to that sentry. You just pick one of the other remaining ones. There's
probably just a logistical thing where they're like,
could be,
you know.
Okay, yeah, this N64 could only do so much. So there's a dude character, and he does not take damage from lava. There's a girl character, and she can swim indefinitely without having to take a breath. And a dog character who has some limited hovering to ease up some platforming and access different areas.
I always played the dog.
And you could just play through the game with a single character. You wouldn't be able to see everything because, you know, certain levels require that you switch the characters out in order to access different areas and go in different directions. So it's just kind of cool that they have some ambitious level design in that way. You can save anywhere. That's pretty next gen.
Wow, that's pretty...
Yeah. Not every game allows you to save everywhere. I mean, Ocarina of Time did. But like Mario 64, you had to beat a level before you save. And Star Fox, you really have to save. They didn't really give you an option. It was more of an arcade run all over and over again. GoldenEye, you can only save in between missions. Anyway, I'm going to stop going through the top five. overall, it's a pretty good-looking N64 game.
You know? Yeah, I'm seeing. I'm watching a video right here. He was just playing through. He kind of like went to kind of like a rundown building and through a graveyard. And it's got fog, and they're messing a lot with the depth and everything with the fog. I thought that was it's pretty good.
I wonder if that's from Rare Replay for its original N64 footage.
Supposedly it is. By search, it is
good. Yeah, I think that they have like little cut scenes. Not too much voice acting that I noticed. But I was having some audio issues with the cable, so I might have been cutting in and out when they were doing voices. It's a pretty long game. There's a substantial amount of worlds. There's 15.
Oh, God.
And according to how long to beat, it can take anywhere from like 15 to 20 hours to get through. So pretty substantial.
Wow, that is very long for a game like this.
I'm watching a very efficient long play of it right now, and it's still 8 hours and 15 minutes.
Jeez. All right.
Yeah.
I wonder what speedrun of this looks like.
That'd be funny to see a speedrun. They're probably like ripping the game apart at the seams, though. Like, when I watch a speedrun, I like to watch like really efficient high-level play rather than I'm going to clip through this wall and skip three levels, you know?
4 hours. Took according to these videos.
Not bad. Not bad at all. At the time, the game reviewed pretty well. You know, eights, nines, that kind of thing. So real, real, real good. There was a planned sequel or different version for the Game Boy Color, but that was canceled. And you can only play this game on the original N64 cart or through the Rare Replay Collection on the Xbox.
Gross.
Those are the only two options, yep. And original carts will go for about $15 to $20 on Amazon. I don't know. It seems okay. I haven't put a ton of time into it because of... mostly just obsessing over old Resident Evil games in the month of October.
And Pokemon.
The update came out. So, no, I haven't put a ton of time into it. I think that if there was... I think the biggest thing... I'm bracing myself here. The biggest thing this game could use is a map. So you're able to track your progress a little bit better. Because I got into an area and... I wasn't sure where to go next, and I started backtracking to see if there were other like branching paths, and I wasn't really able to track my progress backwards. Anyway, just something that makes it a little bit friendlier to, you know, more modern sensibilities. Maybe there is a map. Maybe I just wasn't pressing the right button.
Maybe you had to press A and B at the same time.
Oh, shit.
Wouldn't that be a thing?
Good point. I think with like the original Final Fantasy back on the NES was like that, like... You could only access the map by pressing like start and select at the same time. It was weird.
That's bizarre.
So, let's move over and do some more movies here, because I got a couple more.
You got some good ones in this one.
Some good what?
Some good movies.
Well, I've also noticed a couple you're kind of missing that I think would be worth
bringing Please, up. Jump in.
I had one, what was it?
Towards the end of the month, though. So okay. If we're going to stick chronologically, then...
Yeah, let's just keep moving chronologically.
Like, in our date order, even, you know.
On the 15th, we got a couple of movies. The Story of Us, directed by Rob Reiner. This one I have not seen. Okay, have either of you guys seen this one?
No. I have. Could you give me a premise?
I could not. It stars Michelle Pfeiffer and Bruce Willis, and was directed by Rob Reiner, so I thought it would at least be worth mentioning.
Is it the one where the guy gets his leg gets his foot broken?
It's funny because I wrote down like a list of Rob Reiner films: Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men.
Misery is one of those oddball ones that he's done, because generally he does more of a light-hearted romp of a film.
True Yeah. I mean, like, but still like a pretty good like pretty decent spectrum, because, you know, A Few Good Men isn't exactly, like, a comedy or anything, you know.
Oh, yeah, fair point. Not everything. Stand By Me is not really a comedy. I mean, it's got funny moments, but it's not really meant to be a comedy.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's out of everyone that all the directors on this list, I think he's probably got to like maybe the second or third most impressive filmography out of everybody here, but neither here nor there, because the other movie that came out on October 15th is Fight Club.
Yeah.
Directed by David Fincher, who also directed Alien 3, 7, The Social Network, which is a very strange movie to go back and watch now, considering the sort of...
what's become of, kind of where history has gone with Mark Zuckerberg as an individual.
Yeah.
It would be kind of interesting.
I mean, I don't know anything that happened to him after that movie.
He allowed the Russians to ruin our election.
Oh!
Yeah.
Good job, Mark.
That's what happened to him.
I mean, because it portrayed him as kind of being just a shitty individual that was willing to fuck over anybody to kind of get his way.
Yeah, that movie was not good for him.
Yeah, and then to see what he's really done, it's sort of like he went from being what everyone was going to be like, man, he's just kind of a scummy douchebag, to being like, wow, he ended up being one of the major players in this course of modern politics because of his decisions.
Yeah.
They continue to this day. Like...
And this is just the dude that made Facebook.
It's innocuous to think that it's the guy that made Facebook, but Facebook itself is kind of an evil corporation. It does a lot of terrible stuff. And there have been people that have come out from former employees of Facebook that have said that, they have a right-leaning agenda. They suppress progressive views. They've done nothing to stop the misinformation that comes our way from foreign nations. They want to make a buck. They will sell any ad, and they actually will gladly market propaganda from other nations against America.
They did just recently ban QAnon content, so congratulations for doing the least you could do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did see the Borat movie, which, by the way, everybody should see that movie. it's fucked up, but it's great. It really is awesome.
Okay.
But that is actually one of the bumpers that comes up. What they say is that literally it took... the day of it released, it had only been 10 days prior that Facebook said that they wouldn't be doing that. And they basically had to get publicly shamed into doing it.
Yeah.
And threatened legal action against.
Right.
What is it?
What?
Well, yes. What?
QAnon?
Yeah. Or taking on the QAnon.
It's a fucked up conspiracy theory. It's just stupid. It's stupid shit. Well, we'll talk about it off air because it would take too long.
I love how ignorant I am. It's great.
No, it's good. It gives me hope for the world that there are people who don't have to be exposed to this bullshit.
Well, it's just sad because so many people jumped onto it without understanding. It's sort of like Scientology. Somebody compared it to Scientology.
Oh.
Where it's sort of like...
how much do I need to spend to get to the 16th level?
Bingo. You bring up the levels, right? Like, when you first get into Scientology, you think it's probably just a positive, feel-good movement, and it's about... self-actualization and having a positive mental image, a self-image.
Oh, I don't think that at all with Scientology.
For people,
I think
that
aliens
get into it. That's what they're selling you.
Oh, okay.
And they don't tell you that we're all the souls of aliens that are trapped in volcanoes. Like that's something that happens at the very tail end of it.
You're deeply invested.
Yeah, when you're so far into it, and much like I think a lot of the people in the GOP are, where they've invested so much of themselves in this that they can't. Say maybe I was wrong.
Yeah,
you know. So, and that's kind of what this whole QAnon thing is. They don't tell you what fucking batshit insane thing is at the end of the tunnel. They just kind of start off with like, "Don't you hate those dirty libs?" You know, and then next thing you know, you're talking about the cannibal pedophiles.
Don't you hate those people that want to give you healthcare?
But we digress. How did we even get to this? We're talking about Rob Reiner, I thought.
David Fincher, Social Network.
Oh, Social Network, yeah. So that's not even the film we should be talking about.
Right, Fight Club.
Fight Club.
Fight Club is, I think, a fascinating film for its time. I think that I can't really recall too many films of this era where you get such an anti-hero. Such a blatantly awful person.
Yeah.
And he ends up kind of in this... kind of fucked up little romance, like, akin to maybe like the Joker and Harley Quinn, and to an extent, where you know the general premise is that this guy is so like his life feels so meaningless that he takes up weird habits like going to self help groups, such as cancer survivors, even though he's never suffered from cancer, or kind of just to watch other people's suffering. It's kind of a weird quirk that he has, but it's something to keep him alive.
In a way, as an outlet to sort of purge his own repressed emotions.
Yeah. So, you know, he runs into this woman who's literally doing the same thing.
Uh-huh.
She's going, like, literally going to, like, a testicular cancer support group, even though she's a woman. From her perspective, I think it's interesting because she basically sees this guy who's just this passive weirdo like her, and who then suddenly every other time she sees him, he's either back to being this weird guy or he's this, like, macho, like, fucking alpha dude or whatever. And it's because he's essentially got these two competing personalities trying to control his body. By the way, the movie starts with the fucking end of the movie. Love that. What a great twist. Well, not a twist, but, like, what a great, like, catcher.
It establishes, like, a superstructure. It's like, you know where it's going.
Like, this is where we're already here. It's like, oh, things are gonna go. This is gonna be a fucking story. And then you kind of watch that as he finds out that there are so many disaffected men across America who feel as though this thing that they were told would exist for them doesn't, and that they have lost their ambition, and that they feel like they're just kind of stuck and pointless. I think he even says it at one point. He says he, like, feels like we're a generation of men raised by our mothers. Like, we never really had that patriarchal structure. So again, all kinds of just kind of deep fucked up stuff that I think is particularly relevant for an American man growing up in the 90s.
Still very apropos, I think, because you still have a lot of the, you know, especially white men in America who have that very disaffected, like, they feel like they've been left behind culturally speaking. Like, the culture has moved past white men and now, like, we're like an afterthought, or are villainized. And, you know, I think that those sort of, those emotions that people feel, like they're being left behind culturally, I think if they feel that way, their feelings are valid. But I would advise white men to then think about, if you feel like you're being left behind culturally, think about what it would be like to be left behind economically, politically, by a justice system, to be disaffected by all these things at the same time, and realize that's how a lot of other people feel. So as strongly as you feel about being left behind culturally, other people feel that way about so many other things.
Yeah, this is sympathy. This is not sympathy. It's empathy is what you should experience towards them, because this is a shared experience you're having, except the other people that you think are victimizing you have it way worse than you.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, everyone has a right to be pissed about their place in America. I think vast majority of Americans have a right to be pissed about their standing in America with all that we contribute to it. It could certainly be spread out a little better. I know we're talking about politics now. We're talking about things like socialism.
It's a very political film.
I think that, the wealth disparity with the richest Americans is so obscene. And to think that we are a nation that struggles to, like, give kids lunch and to provide health care and do some really kind of basic fundamental stuff that would just make our nation just function.
Yeah. And I think one of the overarching, like, themes or lessons that come out or should be gleaned out of a movie like Fight Club is trying to redirect that rage, redirect that sort of feeling of disaffection to the correct places.
By tearing down the pillars, tearing down that which holds up the entire system.
It's not to turn it against the person who you feel is disaffecting you. It's to turn into the larger, okay, so what are the systems that are perpetuating the sort of inequality? And by realizing that, like, it's not the illegal immigrant, it's not the black person, you know, it's not all these other people, perceived others, that are disaffecting me. It's
funny point. It's corporate America, really. Yeah. If there's a villain from Tyler Durden's perspective, it's corporate America.
Yep.
Which is crazy because all the Republicans are doing right now benefits corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, it tries to decrease their taxes as possible.
Yep.
The thing that would then fund our nation.
Well, because they would. There's a lie that that you know, the Republican Party in general, and you know, people who are interested in preserving their own wealth, that you will one day be able to have this too. Like, you work hard, you try hard enough, and you will have. You can have all this. That's the American dream.
Somebody described poor Republicans as that, as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. But yeah, we're not really talking about this movie. This is a fucking stylish film. Mm, it has got so much, and that's David Fincher's thing. He's very much a technician of film. I just remember it having such just kind of like grit to it and this grime. A lot of
It's very dirty.
Yeah, shot in very interesting ways. Tons of crazy cuts, just probably cutting a lot more. The editing on it is all over the place.
Yeah, manic. Yeah, it has a really kinetic energy to it.
Yeah, and that kind of helps when you're dealing with a character that has split personalities.
Yep.
Yeah, they messed up the reel, too. At some point, Brad Pitt's just blinking in. And just
there are a couple of points.
Yeah, see the gold dong there, too. But, yeah.
Really snappy dialogue. Like, Edward Norton narrates a lot of it. And like really, really like dry, witty stuff too.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, who's the author of this book?
Chuck Palahniuk.
Chuck Palahniuk. Yeah, I've read a number of his books, and that is very much his acerbic style of wit.
Yeah. John, you know how I read?
I do.
Oh. I am comic books. Okay.
I am literate. but yeah, like Wes, you derailed me. I had a thought. I think. Chuck Palahniuk. His writing reminds me a bit of George Carlin. You know, that's a bit of a lofty comparison, but
you don't read
the
books.
The sort of I have read two books, and this is one of them.
The good book,
really?
Yeah, the good book, the Holy Bible.
What book you need?
Not cover to cover, so I'm not counting that one. This and Catch 22. But the sort of very very subversive, but then also
you read the Spark Notes on that one.
Yes,
on the good book.
I saw the movie. It was good.
You know those college things you can buy. Just the important things.
Our
you buy
Spark
the quiz.
Notes still a thing? I think we're showing our age a bit here.
There's a this is also going to be kind of weirdly timed, but there's Blinkist now exists.
Okay.
Yeah, like a podcast I listen to, they advertise it. I'm certainly not recommending anyone do it.
What is it?
Oh, it's a condensed audiobook form, 15-minute books.
Oh, interesting.
Of only nonfiction. 15 to 20 minutes, I think. So, again, they wouldn't do a fictional book, because that would kind of be like Spark Notes, which is in a way kind of a really shitty thing if you think about it. But, yeah, they're sort of like summarizing what...
Yeah, here's World War II in 15 minutes. You're like, what the f...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could probably pick up like a brief history of time.
I just need to know who won.
It would try to do its best. Again, I'm not saying this is a good product or anyone really should pursue it. Maybe it is a good product. I don't know. But yeah, to try to take a
God, the amount of audiobooks I go through that are 19 hours, and like I don't need short. Ugh.
Yeah,
I'm burning through 19-hour audiobooks.
But, and anyway, like I kind of want to revisit this movie. Like I haven't seen it in forever. It'd be fun. And oh god, like the movie he made after this, like, is Panic Room. One of my all-time favorite movies.
Really?
Really? Panic Room?
I haven't seen Panic Room in a long time.
I think people won't give it any props. That thing is so subtly genius.
I think we got a David Fincher double feature here.
Yeah. We could fucking feature any of these guys' movies. Like, any of this guy's movies. Like, they're all fucking great. I really do love Fincher.
Yeah, there are a lot of really great directors putting out some content here. And then, of course, you know, House on the Haunted Hill. But we'll get to that.
Oh, we'll get to that.
Pokemon Yellow came out on October 19th for both the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color. And this is the well-known third version of Gen 1, fourth version in Japan, because they had a red, green, blue, and yellow. Based on the animated series, we've all played Pokemon Yellow, yes?
Yes.
We've all played this version.
Yes.
Yeah.
Based on the animated series, you only get the one starter option in Pikachu, just like in the show. Your rival, funnily enough, gets an Eevee, which I think like every time I played the game, he turns it into a Jolteon. I don't know if he ever turns it into something else.
In the animated show,
yes,
it becomes a Umbreon.
Good, that's the
because
best one.
It gets into that gen by the time they get back to him. Really,
okay.
So he has an Umbreon that follows him around. Because that is the best Eevee, anyway. So.
Indeed, it is.
I mean, I always liked Gary's team.
Yeah, as of Gen 5.
Gary's team is always just awesome.
So, you can get the other starter Pokemon in Pokemon Yellow pretty easily. They're all just kind of gifted to you throughout different.
Yeah, I think you get the third one by the second town by Cerulean. You can pick up the third, I think.
I think, if I remember correctly, you get Squirtle in Vermilion before the SR, or you can pick it up before the SSN. Charmander is above Nugget Bridge. I don't remember Bulbasaur, though.
I think he's in.
No. So you can live your dream of playing through the game with all three starters and not have to do the whole porting over and over again.
But
we did it.
We all, of course, did the Ash Ketchum team, right?
Of course we have.
At least one time.
Yeah, of course we have.
Yep.
If you haven't, then God.
I did the Brock team.
It was just Onyx and Geodude the entire
four
time.
Geodudes and Onyx. Get ready, everybody.
Some of the gym fights were remixed. Lieutenant Surge, for example, only had a Raichu, like in the show. I think Koga's team was a little bit remixed as well. You do fight Jesse and James. There's some extra Team Rocket fights in there with them as the, of course, the aggressors or the opponents in your fight. It still had some version exclusives, so it was still necessary to do some trading with the other versions to get all 150 if you wanted to. There was some data mining not too long ago. I think it was when the game was coming to the 3DS Virtual Console, or maybe even later than that. Someone did some data mining with the Yellow version, and there were some hints that there was plans to do a Pink version, which of course never came to fruition.
God, what else could they have fucking done? I mean,
I think there probably maybe would have been a Jigglypuff version. Because Jigglypuff was a pretty popular character on the show.
Ugh.
Like, it was well known because it was fucking obnoxious.
Yeah.
It wasn't popular.
Because everybody fucking hated the thing. And they play Smash Brothers, somebody plays Jigglypuff, you go, what are you doing with your life?
Well, they'd have to remix the moveset a little bit too in Gen 1, because it doesn't learn an offensive move until like level 9. So, you know, you'd be starting the game at level 5 and only be able to sing and struggle to gain your levels.
Yeah, they would have to probably give it Pound.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's the one that picks up later on. They'd have to give it to it earlier. They remixed Pikachu's moveset in that version, because prior to Yellow version, it didn't learn Thunderbolt on its own. But in Yellow version, it does learn Thunderbolt. And I think in the game going forward, it learns Thunderbolt without a TM.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can get a used cart of Pokemon Yellow for like $50.
God!
Kind of pricey. But yeah. A lot of those are surprisingly really expensive. I think like Heart Gold, Soul Silver are pretty pricey as well.
Yeah, we talked about this a few months ago where it's just all of these old carts, these Pokemon carts, are super pricey. You can get this one in the 3DS Virtual Console, like I mentioned, for like $10, so a bit pricier than other Game Boy and Game Boy Color games, but a lot more digestible than $50.
True.
You guys want to talk about some comics?
We can talk a little bit.
So, in 1999, Marvel Comics was specifically X-Men Comics. That's all I really know.
God.
There were a couple of things that I think were worth mentioning. We've talked a bit about the ongoing series through the months, and I'm not going to go issue by issue here what's happening in each individual one. The thing that they're building up to at this point is an event called The 12. I'll probably get more into depth on that one on a later retro show because it hasn't happened in the chronology just yet. But leading up to that, there are a couple of series, Astonishing X-Men as well as Bishop the Last X-Men, that are both, you know, pretty relevant to...
It's the one where he gets a sex change.
I get it.
Because he was...
It was not written by Chris Claremont, though.
He's X-Man.
Yeah, yes. It's a great joke. but Bishop of the Last X-Men is Bishop's solo series. And Bishop was an interesting character in the 90s. He was pushed very heavily in the 90s because he was like this big, badass dude who carried like a lot of big guns. He was a little bit like Cable, and he was also from the future. So there are a lot of parallels between those two.
Did he have that same kind of technovirus thing?
He did not. He didn't have the technovirus.
He had his power was he would absorb energy and then shoot it out of his gun.
Right. Well, he could
by
also...
By his gun, you mean
his penis. Yeah. Why are you confused about this?
So in the TV show, he would use his gun, but in the comics, he would just like channel it out of his hands. I don't think it would have to be his hands. I think he could use any appendage.
Why would he not exclusively use his penis?
Oh, maybe he'd have to wear pants or he'd ruin
crotchless slacks.
He wears a lot of scarves, doesn't he? I feel like he constantly has like kafayas on, right?
So he had a lot of different looks throughout the 90s. He had the neckerchief,
the cowboy,
and the Jerry curl.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like the staple look for just Resistance. you had to have a fucking scarf and some kind of.
Yeah. Well, it was uniform, like his cop uniform of the future, because he worked. He was an officer in, I think it was the Xavier Security Enforcers, and they were basically mutants who policed other mutants, which seems a little inappropriate. But
is this like the replicant thing? And
yeah, maybe freaking, he's like Deckard.
Yeah, Blade Runner.
But he ends up coming to the X-Men time, decades in the past for him. He's from the late 21st century. He goes back to the past because he's pursuing a fugitive named Fitzroy. And Fitzroy is a villain character who's around for a while in the 90s, then just kind of disappears midway through. But he is a time traveler, but he has to, drain the life force out of people in order to use his powers. So he's always like a wake of bodies, and that's why Bishop's always trying to catch up with him. But he's always one step ahead. So Bishop is back in the past and decides to stick around in the past. Well, decides. He can't get back. It's not like the TV show. He's not, he doesn't have like time travel devices or anything. He follows Fitzroy back in one of like the portals that Fitzroy makes.
Quick question.
Yes.
So what is Fitzroy's power other than murdering people?
Time travel.
He time travels, but yeah. He has to murder people in order to time travel.
Right. Right.
Okay.
So, he follows him back. His two buddies that come back with him end up dying. He joins up with the X-Men. He has heard of all the X-Men, and he's got like this sort of like weird beef with Gambit, because he knows Gambit in the future. But he kind of gets a little bit of amnesia, so he's not quite sure why he doesn't like Gambit.
Now it's a Spanish soap opera.
Right. But, you know, this is a character who stuck around for a few years, but then I don't think the writers really know what to do with him. So, and I wrote this issue down, Uncanny X-Men 341, he kind of gets removed from the main happenings of the X-Men events, because they end up going into space to help the Shi'ar Empire. So the X-Men, it was just after the events of not Extinction Agenda, god damn it, no, I forget the event. Anyway, it was after a big event involving Sentinels and Bastion as a villain, and the X-Men are out like Christmas shopping and doing each other, they're ice skating and shit, and the Shi'ar enforcer guy Gladiator comes to Earth and he needs to find the X-Men. So what's he do? He's looking around and he finds Cannonball. He's like, hey Cannonball, and grabs him by the head, which I guess is like some sort of weird Shi'ar way of saying hello. And Cannonball's like, dude, what the fuck, why are you grabbing my head? So they fight, and by the end of their fight he was like, no, I just need the X-Men's help. And, like, the other X-Men had shown up at that point. He's like, well, why don't you just fucking say something? Why are you grabbing people by the head, you weirdo? So he's like, don't worry about it. You need to go save the Shi'ar Empire. So he, like, teleports them off. And, like, as they're teleporting off, except Cannonball. Cannonball's useless. He's not allowed to go. Instead of Cannonball, Beast's girlfriend, who is just a reporter lady, ends up going too. Because she's more capable than Cannonball. So they go off into space, and Gladiator's like, okay, good luck. And they're like teleporting away. You're not coming? Like, no, I can't. And they're like, why not? And then just cuts the next panel. So they go to space. They help.
He needs to say goodbye where he grabs his crotch.
Like, I'm staying here with Cannonball. And they start this illicit love affair where they just grab each other by the head. So the X-Men, it's Rogue, Gambit, Beast's girlfriend, Bishop, and Joseph, the sort of clone of Magneto, go into space. They help the Shi'ar Empire.
There's some kind of joke, like bar joke in here. They walk into a bar. Like,
yes, it is. They go to space. They're there for several issues. They help the Shi'ar Empire. They end up then traveling back to Earth. On the way there, on the way to help the Shi'ar Empire, they join up with Deathbird, who is Lilandra, the Empress of the Shi'ar Empire, that's her sister, who's very devious and always trying to overthrow the Empire, but then they're like, yeah, okay, you can help for some reason, even though she's going to betray them all. On the way back, Deathbird is with them, but through a series of events, Bishop and Deathbird get separated, and then the rest of the X-Men team end up back on Earth in the Savage Land, and that's when, you know, you find out that Joseph is probably a clone of Magneto, and that Gambit betrayed or led the team of Marauders to the Morlock Tunnels where the mutant massacre happened, and then they abandoned Gambit in Antarctica because he did that. Anyway, but Bishop is still in space with Deathbird, and you re-encounter him again on a separate spaceship with Deathbird, where it's like, to bring this back, like a Misery situation where he's like in a bed and she's like, hey, you're paralyzed, so I'm gonna take care of you until I can help you. And he's like sitting in the bed paralyzed, like, okay, let's do that then. And then it turns out later that he wasn't paralyzed. She was just keeping him captive because she's obsessed with him. And he's like, that's not cool. Let's fuck anyway. So they do. Yes. And they just have like this weird sort of romance. And then, of course, they go fight more Shi'ar battles and do some shenanigans
there. Sounds like the new show that's on, I heard it's a commercial, or this little girl is basically paralyzed, and her mom takes care of her. Turns out the mom's drugging her in order to keep her. Like,
that's horrifying. What is that?
It's I think it's a run.
That's actually a psychological disorder that happens to some moms and dads, I guess.
Yeah.
Too, presumably, where they kind of intentionally poison their kids for the sake of like
wanting being sympathy. Having to take care of them.
Yeah, that's crazy. I can't wait for these children to move out. So
much love in here. We just carved pumpkins.
Yeah, it was fun.
Mika with a knife, it was great.
Hangs out with Deathbird in space. They have space adventures where they fuck and they kill people. And then he ends up being able to get back to Earth through a portal. She stays where she is. They sort of break up. And when he gets back to Earth, he's kind of moping around the X-Mansion. He's like, I don't know, so many things have changed. Operation Zero Tolerance, that was the event. Some stuff had happened while he was away. He was like, I don't know where I fit in anymore. And the writer was like, I don't know where you fit in anymore either. So they decide to send him to the future again. And they do this with the character Fitzroy that I brought up. So Bishop's like, okay, I'm back. I guess I might as well do the thing that I came to the past to do. I'm going to go find that Fitzroy guy finally. So he goes looking for him by finding his sister Shard, who isn't like his real sister, but it's like a pretty good copy of his sister, because his real sister died in the future, and then he came to the past, and they were able to like make a hologram of her that then kind of adopted her consciousness somehow, even though she was dead in the future. Doesn't matter. That's Shard. She's a hologram lady. He finds hologram Shard, who's not his sister.
God, all right.
Shard's a confusing character. But she's cool, though. So he finds her, and Fitzroy, who was obsessed with Shard, real flesh and blood Shard in the future, kind of has her as a hostage. For some reason, he's just got her in this motel room, or like a rundown apartment, and he is...
And she's paralyzed, and he says he's going to take care of her.
And he is like also using this as like just like a killing stage, where he keeps on like killing people so then he can make portals to the future, and he's going further into the future than where he originated, where he has like taken over like this dystopian, like this area of a dystopian future, and like calls himself the Chronomancer, and there are like Jamie Madrox clones that are his army. You don't find out they're Jamie Madrox clones until later.
I don't know who Jamie Madrox is.
Multiple Man. They're Multiple Man dupes.
Okay.
That's a great name, by the way. Chronomancer?
The Chronomancer?
I mean, yeah. I don't think I've ever heard that used before. It sounds so cliche.
But it's but the devious.
Yeah.
It's like, of course you're the fucking Chronomancer, but cool name. So he, Bishop's like, okay, well, he's escaping to the future, I gotta follow him. So he follows him. This other little kid, Michael, gets kind of caught up in it, so he becomes like the sort of character that needs to protect throughout the run. So there's a good year and a half or 2 years where Bishop has this ongoing series where it's him in the far future fighting the Chronomancer, Fitzroy, and the sort of journey he has to go on in order to find, like, the Chronomancer lair, because he's got, like, this castle and shit. And it's, like, there's kind of, like, this medieval retro future where there are, like, roaming bands of bandits and fucking, like, gargoyles who are terrorizing towns and shit. And he kind of, like, builds this band of X-Men who, like, have heard of the X-Men, but it's kind of distant past, so it's more, like, mythology type of stuff. It's, like, pyrokinetic guy whose name is Scorch. There's a speedster girl whose name is Jinx. Like, kind of like form their own superhero team in the future. I know it was a pretty good book, but pretty much it functioned as a way to just remove Bishop from the landscape without having to kill him off or giving him something to do in the actual X-Men happenings.
Or fusing it into a giant bullet that flies through space.
Right, or putting him in a giant bullet.
Yeah.
Which is a ridiculous story.
Yeah, it really was. I did read that one.
that's astonishing. That's the Joss Whedon run. I mean, it's a good run, but to me it's silly because the sort of like astrophysics of comics is like there's a planet and it's far away and it's going to shoot a bullet. It's going to take hundreds of thousands of years to get there because apparently things can move faster than light in the X-Men universe. I don't know. It doesn't make much sense.
But who would shoot a planet-sized bullet at a planet? Like, what the
If you have the if you have the technology for that, you'd think you'd come up with a better way.
Better means than a giant bullet killing a planet. I mean, God damn. That angered me.
Oh, that's what did it.
That actually angered me. I was like, what the fuck?
He's the Chronomancer, not the Narrative Man.
The other, there's a little mini-series that started in October of 99, is called Astonishing X-Men. Pretty much what was happening in the X-Men landscape at the time was Xavier was being a huge dick. He was being like a super huge drill sergeant, and he was especially hostile toward Gambit because Gambit was popular, so they wanted to have him be like the anti-establishment counterculture sort of character. And so him and Professor X were really butting heads. And Professor X was, like, trying to be the drill sergeant or the headmaster, and Gambit's like, we're not children, we're all adults here, why are you trying to treat us like we're your students? We're not. And it ends with Xavier saying, I'm disbanding the X-Men, everybody leave. And everybody leaves but Storm. And it all turns out to be a ruse because he's trying to figure out who is the imposter in the X-Men, and it is Wolverine. At this time, Wolverine is a Skrull. I think I've talked about that one a few shows ago, because the real Wolverine has become the Horseman of Death, leading up to the events of the 12. About Astonishing X-Men is a few characters going off on a little adventure to save the Manites, who are these genetically engineered, superpowered children built by the U.S. government. Well, the team is the most interesting thing because it was Cyclops and Jean, as well as Skrull Wolverine. It's not real Wolverine. And then Angel, Warren Worthington, Cable, and Nate Summers. So you have two versions of... Because Nate Summers and Cable, Nathan Summers, are the same person, but Nate Summers is from the Age of Apocalypse storyline. So you have two of the same character. And there they're going around, they go to save these kids. They encounter Death, who is the actual Wolverine, the Horseman of Death. And they fight him a couple of times. But I don't think this is where it gets officially revealed that he is real Wolverine. Because at the end of this storyline, there's a miniseries, there's three issues. At the end of these three issues, Wolverine dies. But not real Wolverine, Skrull Wolverine. And then the X-Men storyline picks back up with them bringing him back. And like, oh, I can't believe Wolverine is dead. And then Professor X sort of initiates this sort of a civil war exercise. He kind of like controls people telepathically and has them fight each other just to make sure he's rooted out the only imposter. And then at the end of it, when the X-Men think that they've all been like fighting and killing each other, he like flicks the psychic switch. Is like, never mind, everything's fine. And that's where they should have been like, you're a fucking dick, and punched him in the head. But they didn't. And they're worse off for it.
So what else in October 1999?
Bringing Out the Dead.
That's a great movie.
Came out October 22nd, directed by Martin Scorsese. Probably one of the five best living film directors right now. Also directed such movies as Raging Bull, The Aviator, Taxi Driver, The Departed, Goodfellas, Gangs of New York.
I've heard of some of these movies.
Yeah, so some pretty solid films in there. Yes. The early 90s were a weird time for Scorsese.
Yeah.
Because this is kind of a weird movie from him. I watched this one a few days ago, just kind of get a refresher on it. I actually don't remember if I'd ever seen this one or not.
I've seen this movie a bunch of times.
Yeah? Please.
As I remember, basically the premise is that you're sort of tagging along Nick Cage, and he's with a series of different paramedics.
Yeah.
And they're driving around. So I don't believe it's ever really the same paramedic twice. But it's the likes of
John Goodman.
Yeah, John Goodman.
Ving Rhames.
I'm trying to think who's the really fucking crazy guy.
His ex partner that he gets teamed up with again. I don't remember.
I'm trying to think of the actor's name. But yeah, and it's I want to say that he's suffering from sleep deprivation.
Yeah, probably.
And I think he's taking a lot of drugs himself and stuff like that. So yeah, it just ends up being a real kind of drugged out film. In spite of the fact that it's from the view of the paramedics, the people that should be arriving to the scene to help. I just remember it's just a real trip, very Train-Spotting-like.
Yeah, it's very, like what we were talking about, Fight Club, very dirty, very grimy.
Yeah.
Almost grotesque in the way that it did.
Everything feels like it's wet concrete.
Yeah. It's also not very empathetic to people with drug addiction or homelessness or people who are forced to live in these sort of impoverished conditions. It's very much like a 90s viewpoint of sort of crime and poverty and then the sort of like a pessimism or almost like condescension that it treats these sort of economic conditions that people are not choosing to live in.
It was really wild to make such a cynical film at this time, too, because looking back on it now, knowing what the next 21 years are going to be like ahead of this, these are fucking good times, man. This was definitely, if it's a line graph, right, this is kind of heading towards a peak that falls off dramatically after the events of 9/11.
Yeah.
So, again, really weird seeing Fight Club and this movie come out, you know.
Yeah.
They got some shit. There's some shit to be cynical about.
I think like one of the things that struck me about this movie is
God, Bill Clinton's the president.
Right.
Oh God.
Like that's fucking. Okay. Sorry. What were you gonna say?
They reminded me like the Nick Cage character reminded me a lot of the Howard Hughes character that DiCaprio played in The Aviator, because you're just kind of like watching his slow spiral downward, and like the character doesn't ever really get better or have like this. Meaningful personal growth. You're watching this decay of a character, which is something that Scorsese does several times. So you put like Raging Bull is a lot of the same sort of a character journey where you're not like seeing an improvement of a character. You're seeing that descent. But yeah, it's interesting. It's not something that you see a ton of other film directors do with their protagonist, the one you're supposed to be following and rooting for. But yeah, it's an interesting movie.
Yeah, it kind of it just feels very different from his other films.
Yeah,
honestly, when you think of how clean and polished Goodfellas is,
or like Casino, like those are also movies. I think those are early '90s. But yeah, those are very like glamorous.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was one other one. There was in the 90s, he also did that one. I forget its name.
Was it King of Comedy? Is that what you're thinking of?
King of Comedy was in the 70s. I really like that one,
too. That's way back.
It was the one about like the 14th Dalai Lama. I forget the name of it. It's
not Last Something, is it?
No. I don't know, maybe. But that was another, like, sort of a diversion. Where, you know, a lot of times, like, you associate Scorsese with the sort of, like, gangster movies, because he's made so many of them, that it's interesting to see him take these sort of deviations into something that's not typical. And then, finally...
Well, is that what you had to book in some features?
Yeah, please.
Because there are some things I missed. One is actually a huge, huge film.
Which one?
Well, two from Japan. So they did an American and English dub of it. And that would be when it was released, Princess Mononoke.
Oh, great Studio Ghibli movie.
Yeah, that's a fantastic film.
Yep.
Take us away, Wes.
Yeah. I can't even tell you about the movie at this point. It's been years. I just know I thoroughly enjoyed it.
As I remember, general premise is...
something like some kind of like corruption in the land or something, and they gotta kill this thing, and...
Yeah, essentially, yeah. There's like a young guy who's sort of, I think he's supposed to be kind of like a bodyguard, traveling around with these people that are essentially clear-cutting the forest and pissing off all of the spirits of the wild. And then you have a young girl in it, the main character, Mononoke, who is sort of raised by wolves, kind of. She's more on the side of the animals that are, again, themselves, like these... big, powerful creatures that embody the virtues of nature. And you're sort of seeing, human innovation, with guns and steel butt heads with nature itself. And it's a very just big, grand thing. It's beautifully animated. Characters are really cool. I loved it, yeah. I think I remember at the time when this was coming out, everyone was sort of like, this is the most high-profile, not Disney animated thing ever made.
Mm.
So, like, kind of worthy of getting attention here in America.
I mean, it's Studio Ghibli. I mean, at this point, with Studio Ghibli's, they made some Kiki's Delivery Service, Howl's Moving Castle comes years later.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now I feel like they're more of a household name, and I think it's anime itself has become much more mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I feel like this is really solidifies in America the significance of Japanese animation, and that they've been doing it better than us the whole time.
Yeah,
sure, we got Disney. We got Disney making these, and there was that golden age of Disney's from like the mid-80s into the mid-90s where pound for pound, it's the best animation that's ever been made. I guess you could argue the 60s golden age of Disney as well, but sorry, I'm cutting off.
I think like at the time they're pretty much the only game in town.
Yeah.
As far as animated films.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, and also I don't think that I couldn't get a solid release date, so I'm not going to go into it, but Toy Story 2 came out around this time.
Mm.
I think that 3D animation is now the big thing.
Yeah.
For all of the big features that come out and doing a, Disney style or like these Miyazaki films, which are so cool. Yeah. Oh, and the voice actors. I think the voice acting is pretty cool on the American dub. It's Billy Crudup and Claire Danes, okay. Homewrecker, ruined that. And somehow the two of them ended up getting work together. They're probably fucking in the studio. We also got Minnie Driver plays a really interesting character. She's a woman that sort of leads the group of military guys.
Hmm.
There's this really tragic scene. Oh, and by the way, wow, there's so many amazing action set pieces in it.
And that's the thing with this one as well, opposed to like a lot of the Studio Ghibli movies, it's a lot more violent and like gory than the others. Like, this is a straight up PG-13 movie. You can't take your kids after seeing Totoro and then just go watch this and see people get chopped in half and deer heads go flying. I mean, you just can't do it.
Yeah, oh, that absolutely happens. And it's just a very, very sad film in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And very mature. That was the scene when, it's like they've done this thing to trigger that fight with the boars, and, and the boars are getting slaughtered, and they're like, no, this is going to be our last big stand. We've got them off guard. We're going to get them, and it's only because they've been tricked. they've been duped the whole time, and they're really surrounded by the proverbial wolf in sheep's clothing. It's just the soldiers themselves in the boar skins mm-hmm. of the other boars that they'd slaughtered. So, just as if you're an environmentalist, this movie must really be painful to watch. And yeah, they literally decapitate this, or they put an arrow through the side of the throat of the spirit of the forest, a giant 20-foot elk human thing that then just spills death upon
everything.
It's so fucked. Yeah. Oh, but the rest of the cast, though, like, an interesting cast too. Minnie Driver's there. Billy Bob Thornton is in it.
Oh, wow.
Bender himself, John DiMaggio, he's in it. Gillian Anderson's in it. Keith David, fantastic voice on him. Really cool, and I sort of legitimized that in a way, and just it's a great movie all around. If you're looking for a lighthearted romp, which Miyazaki's made many of, this is definitely not.
No.
Great film though. Oh, a couple more. Audition came out. Did you ever see Audition?
I did not.
Audition was great.
Yeah, Audition is a.
I think if I'm thinking of the same movie. Oh no, go on. I don't know.
Is it Japanese?
Oh nope, I'm thinking something else.
So Audition is really, I don't overstate it and say it's like revolutionary, but it was definitely a mindfuck horror film.
Changed filmmaking forever.
Certainly woke America up to how fucked up Japan can be when it comes to making a horror film. Yeah, no, it's about this woman who is like this kind of submissive individual and basically kidnaps a guy and then just proceeds to start torturing him.
Oh,
I think that's the theme of the show.
Yeah.
Torture?
Being held hostage in torture. We're talking about Misery and Bishop. Now this.
Oh.
Yeah, so and Takashi Miike, he's just known for making lots of just gross out, violent and disturbing films. I think it's this great part where it's like, I think she's answering the call for the audition itself, and you just see her kind of like sitting there, like in a chair, like with the phone and focus, and you can kind of see the background of the room, and she's just like there, and just like being very polite and trying to coordinate it. And then right when she hangs up, you just see a bag start flopping around in the back, and it's a body in there. So yeah, she's basically got this thing where she's like sort of collecting and torturing people. Yeah, it's a wild one, and gruesome, really, really gruesome. It kind of made me think of Nicholas Rafn, the guy that made like Drive and Valhalla Rising, or that one Only God Forgives. Mm-hmm. Reminds me a lot of Only God Forgives, not just because there's a lot of Asian people in it. Dug this movie though, really, really good, and weird that I don't think we've talked about a lot of foreign films when we do these, but
no, not really.
And did you didn't say anything about Being John Malkovich?
Because I was looking at that one, and there seems to be a little bit of confusion about when it was released. I think it maybe came out in limited release in October, but I think it was wide in December.
Okay.
Well, so we'll, I was kind of banking that one.
We don't got to talk about that one. We'll cage that one.
Okay.
That's all we got.
House on Haunted Hill.
Yes.
It was on the 29th.
That is also a movie.
That is a movie, all right.
Yeah.
There are still images that are projected on the screen at 24 frames per second. That is a movie.
Could be, you know,
such
what?
Trash.
I meant to do it. We're running so long in the tooth on this podcast, but like I've seen a ton of horror content lately.
Yeah.
That I wanted to kind of talk about, and it was not House on Haunted Hill.
I watched part of it.
Which part?
I did not make it very long before I was like, "Well, I'm about to shit myself. I'm going to walk away from this." Because it's not something that came out in October 1999, so this would be a very brief tangent, but
sure, yeah.
I've never like read the books, and always like a horror book that seems silly. Like, I don't think I'm going to get scared from reading a book, but I am curious about this movie, because I've always, it's it, and everybody won't shut up about it, so I watched the new one, and it was the first part, and it was the one part where the kid is walking down the street, and then he goes by the house and the door opens. I'm like, all right, this is pretty creepy. And then, you know, the clown shows up with all the balloons and stuff. I'm like, all right, that's pretty,
storm drain, yeah.
That's pretty creepy. And then he goes downstairs later on, and it's like his, I guess it was his dead brother. Is that what it was? In the rain outfit in the flooded basement. And then it comes out like the water. I'm like, fuck this. And I just immediately, you started running at him like, fuck this. I'm just immediately done. I have no interest in watching that movie. Holy hell. All right, go on with your horror movie. Sorry.
House on Haunted Hill is stupid. That's all I really want to say. The interesting, I guess, in a sort of like fourth wall sense, the beginning of the movie, they are shooting. Jeffrey Rush is a character in the movie, so like sort of this theme park designer and operator, which is such a bullshit job, it doesn't exist. They're shooting this scene where he's at like an opening of a new theme park, and it's very clearly Islands of Adventure in Orlando. they're shooting this opening scene on the Hulk roller coaster as it existed in 1999.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. It was just that's really the only thing that stood out to me as noteworthy. Like I'm watching it and like I see a green roller coaster. I'm like, wait a second, and then they show more. I'm like, yup, they're in Orlando.
Some things that stick out for me about this movie. One, there's a great scene where a guy gets decapitated. Like you see his face through this like what do you call it when there's a circle hole in a boat or whatever,
like a porthole.
Yeah, hole. It's like this porthole window, and you see this guy's face, and you're like, oh my god, we found you. And she opens the door, and it's like his decapitated head stuck up against the hole.
Yep.
if I'm remembering correctly, it does have a really ingenious scare where a woman's walking around with a camcorder, and she looks into a room where she just sees like this operating table, and she's like, that's weird. And then she brings it up, and she sees this like gruesome surgery being performed. And it doesn't do it immediately, which is so great, because she's just like sitting there observing the horror of it all. And then she just cuts back to her, and then it cuts back to them. And then they look at her, and then they stare at her, and it's like, oh. This cheesy fucking movie. That is a good scare.
So I agree. That's a really cool device. And then they kill that character, and you don't get any more of that.
Yeah. Chris Kattan?
Chris Kattan's in it.
He's in this Mango himself.
Famke Jensen?
Famke Jensen, yeah. Wait, she's an X-Men. Or she's an X-Lady.
Yep. Ally Lauder?
Yeah. This cover of the Eurythmics' Sweet Dreams by Marilyn Manson is the closing track of the credits. I distinctly remember that. I love that. I don't know why. It just felt so right. It's like after that whole fucking movie. This movie's garbage.
Yeah, I mean, it was no, you know, hat is like a shark's fin, but...
Yeah, well, hey, you know, that's... Hey, we're talking about the greatest soundtrack of all time, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, God.
Can I give you some quick hits on horror films?
Do it.
Okay, so probably the single best thing of horror I saw was actually from last year. It is The Haunting of Hill House that Netflix produced.
Oh, I started watching that. I watched the first episode.
You did?
Yeah.
Holy shit, the thing is fucking incredible.
I needed to watch something more lighthearted after I finished that, because I'm not going to do a second episode of this.
Yes. You want to know what I was...
Was effective.
You want to know what I was watching? This is so weird. But in between all these horror movies and watching this series, it's 10 episodes, I was literally watching 2-episode bursts of Sailor Moon.
Okay.
Because I had to restart my Hulu account. To get one of the movies, because they were going to give me another month free trial. And I was like, okay, I need to not have watched this before I go to bed.
Right.
2 episodes of Sailor Moon. Really just good. It's a palate cleanser. It's a little scoop of sorbet after a
movie. Sailor Moon, of all things.
I remember watching that show when I was a kid. I loved it. So happy to revisit it. And yeah, it's fun. It really holds up. It's actually kind of a cool show. It's corny, and it's, yeah, she's a total fucking ditz, but... her heart's in the right place. You know that tuxedo mask is gonna attack her pretty hard, you know, so that's
there's the one
stage. Isn't there like quite an age disparity,
I mean,
between those two characters?
Probably.
Okay.
I think she's supposed to be like, yeah, I think she's supposed to be like 12 or 13 or something. She's pretty young.
And he's like 30.
Yeah, I think they said that he's like 120. He looks great though.
Yeah. What is this, Twilight? I don't...
Yeah. No, so
Hill House. Yeah.
And I will say, as you're watching that series, keep in mind, episodes 5 and 6 back to back, like, would be one of the best horror films I've ever seen. If you could just put them together. They're not necessarily thematically the same, or really even dealing with the same topic. The show has just this capacity to constantly get you and build tension and suspense. The scares are fantastic. The characters are every single one. You will memorize all 5 of those kids real quick, because each one of them is fucking crucial in their own way. The two parents, and you'll learn to love the dual casting of it. How you have the young versions and the old versions. I'm not gonna spoil anything by saying this, but that 6th episode is called Two Storms, And it literally showcases two nights in which the family was together. And it's done in, I mean, maybe there's cuts. It's basically four shots.
Hmm.
Four shots of them cutting back and forth between what is this one day that they're living through then versus was one day when they were in the house. Absolutely loved it. Episode 5, I didn't even see it coming at all. It pays off like you wouldn't believe. It's so, so fucking good. And then but the whole series is wonderful. The whole series is absolutely wonderful. Like, I just one part where, like, I think it's the second to last episode where it's like, you know, just when I thought I have my nerves have been hardened like steel to this thing, you know, two characters get into a fight and it's just like, finally, let it out. Like, let me just see something on the screen that didn't fucking scare the living shit out of me. And it's just like, I'm so wrapped up in this argument between the two characters. And then maybe the most powerful scare happens in the entire fucking movie. Like, it's great. This is so good. If you love hauntings, if you can observe haunting the House on Haunted Hill and see why it's bad and wish it was something good, just go watch that series. It's fantastic. And there's a new series that just came out called The Haunting of, I think, Bly Manor. I watched the first two episodes. Also really, really good so far. And they recycle a lot of the cast.
Hmm.
Not playing the characters that were in the other series.
Oh, kind of like an American Horror Story kind of thing, where it's like new season, same cast, different.
There you go. Hmm. So Nellie is the young girl. There's two twins,
mm-hmm.
And Nellie is the kid, the girl. She plays the main character in the new series that just started. So that was good. I'll quickly get to the other ones. I saw a great film called Wretched, like Wretched.
Hmm.
Very kind of like adult goosebump spooky in a way. Like this teenage kid ends up going to hang out at his dad's house for the summer, and he thinks the lady next door might be a witch. And hijinks ensue. It's graphically violent, but also it's got a really good humor, and the characters are really fun. Dug it. Crawl came out last year. Alexandre Aja is a French director who makes really violent films like High Tension. He did that Hills Have Eyes remake.
Mm.
He made a movie that's literally about Florida getting hit by a Category 5 hurricane, and then Barry Pepper and his daughter have to hole up in a house while they're being attacked by alligators.
Okay.
I know that sounds...
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it sounds like a Sharknado kind of movie, but it's not at all. It plays it straight. It's actually really, really good. And the... Oh, and there's also, like, no message to it. The movie has no message. It's not trying to do anything. Like, this isn't about global warming. It's not like these are super alligators. It's not like they're trying to... There's not like one giant, massive, angry alligator. It's just fucking alligators. It'd be like if you and me just like, suddenly the water started rising, oh, and there's alligators everywhere. You'd be like, well, fuck my life.
Well, fuck.
Yeah, this is gonna suck. But yeah, it's surprisingly really good. And that director, Alexandre Aja, he makes very attractive looking smut, I guess is how you could describe it. Like, he makes really like refined looking, well edited and shot stuff when he's showing you really gruesome content. That's sort of his thing. He likes that. So if you want something that's not just like, you know, gore for the sake of gore, but actually looks like it's kind of got interesting characters and a good story and really, really well made, you fucking did that.
Mm.
Oh my god, it was literally what we just watched last night for movie night. I loved it. What was it called? It was like this Snow Wolf Mountain. I wish I was more prepared for this. I'm sorry. But yeah, it was gosh, I'm trying to think of the title. Great film. The premise being that it was a police officer is in this small town, and they think that this werewolf is going around and attacking women. And he is slowly losing his own mind, I guess, while all of this is happening around him. And he's trying to solve this murder, and he's dealing with family shit. The Wolf of Snow Hollow is what it's called. Literally just came out a couple weeks ago for, like, streaming. Like, you could rent it if you wanted. But you're watching him try to solve the murder. Someone described it, and it's very, very accurate in a weird way, but they said it was like Fargo meets Silver Bullet. So it's definitely got that gruesome, grizzled horror element, but then it's so darkly funny. And like the main guy in it, he's also the director, I think it's Jim Cumming, he plays the main guy in it. and wrote it and directed it. His performance is just so hilariously manic. Great movie. I like that. And I saw some other horror films, like one called The Lodge, which was fine.
Oh, sure. That's the one with like the lady and her stepkids.
Yeah. That wasn't even really a horror film. Hmm. Did you see it?
I saw the first few minutes.
Yeah.
I kind of lost interest.
I'm not going to spoil anything about it if anyone does want to go see it. Pretty good film.
Okay.
Very, very dry, though. Hmm. Yeah, I watched one BR that... I really went crazy with horror films. I watched one BR, which is a Netflix film that was made for, like, fucking $500,000, I'm sure. This is, like, the smallest fucking budget. But it's good. It's about a girl getting wrapped up in a cult.
Hmm.
So, again, it's one of those movies where it's kind of like Crawl in that it ain't trying to be a big grand thing. It ain't trying to tell you anything new. It's just trying to make a tight little horror thriller. And it accomplished that.
Cool.
So, if anyone has a shotgun blast comment or a horror films, if anyone wants to check those out. All
right, real quick, to wrap things up here.
Yes.
The 1999 World Series.
Oh, God.
And
do we really have to talk about it?
7 minutes. Here we go. Well, the New York Yankees swept the Atlanta Braves for back-to-back World Series victories. They also won in 98. The Braves were a pretty fun team in the 90s. They appeared in the World Series in 91, 92, 95, where they won, 96, where they played the Yankees, and the Yankees won that one, and then again in 99, where again they were facing the Yankees, and the Yankees won.
That's tough.
Yeah.
Was like Dave Justice on that team at the time? Or?
It's not ringing a bell. On the Braves?
Yeah. I remember kind of being
it was like Tom Glavine, John Smoltz,
yeah, there's
Greg Maddux, Chipper Jones.
Yeah, it's a good team.
Yeah. For a while, it was kind of like the big debate. It was like, okay, who's the team of the 90s? Is it the Braves? Is it the Yankees? And, you know, what were the Yankees with? Like, I think they won 3 World Series in the 90s. They're probably like the clear winner of that debate. But the Yankees won the World Series, like I mentioned, in 96 as well as in 98. In 98, they won 125 games in the season. In 99, they went on to, the next year, they went to win 98 games, which is also pretty damn good. The Yankees swept the Rangers in the Divisional Series, and then they played the Red Sox in the Championship Series for the American League. Hard-fought series. Pedro pitched, I think it was game 2, Pedro Martinez, struck out 17, and the Red Sox won that game 13-1, which is pretty great, but they lost the series, which is not so great. And then Atlanta in the National League, in the National League Championship Series, they beat the Mets in a hard-fought series. The Mets, coached at the time or managed at the time by one Bobby Valentine, if that is his real name.
That's not his real mustache.
It sure isn't. So in the actual World Series, Game 1, Orlando Hernandez was pitching for the Yankees. He struck out 8 of the first 11 batters. Tom Glavine was supposed to pitch Game 1 for the Braves, but he had a stomach bug, so he was scratched from Game 1. Greg Maddux pitched instead. Not a terrible number 2 guy to go to. Chipper Jones hit a home run early to go up 1-0. The Yankees didn't actually score until the 8th. Where they had a hit, a walk, a bunt hit. Jeter got a hit. I fucking hate that guy. And then another hit and a walk. So they strung together a good series of just like little slap hits and walks and ended up winning the game. I think I forgot to write down the score here, but I think it was like 3-1. Mariano Rivera, who went on to be the MVP of the series, finished off the game. He like had 3 or 4 games in this series where he went like more than an inning as the closer. Some games he was going like 2 innings to close the game out. Game 2, Yankees slapped around 14 hits and won pretty handily, 7-2. Atlanta didn't even score until the 9th. Game 3, Atlanta went up early, 5-1. They scored 5 runs in the game off of 14 hits, which is not super efficient. Tom Glavine did get his start in this game, though. He was pretty efficient through 7 innings. He threw 72 pitches and went 7 innings. He did give up 3 runs, which wasn't great.
Still grounds for a quality start.
Yeah, still get that QS. things kind of fell apart for him in the 8th inning of work. He went out there. Chuck Knobloch hit a game tying two-run home run in the eighth off of a block. Yeah, off of a relief pitcher.
He's the guy that only had one testicle, right?
Pretty sure. It's all he deserved.
Yeah.
And the Yankees win in the 10th off from a walk-off home run. And then game four, it was Roger Clemens versus John Smoltz. It was good, clean baseball. Nothing really extraordinary about it. Rivera comes in and closes the door again. Yankees win 4-1. And Roger Clemens gets his first World Series ring. That dirty cheater. That's the World Series. And that's the show. Next up is going to be the official show. But we're running out of time this month. So we're probably going to do the official show early.
Right now.
November. Yeah. Marathon show. But for the official show, the Pokemon expansion was a new release. So we could just combine the Pokemon and the official show, if you guys were up for it.
It's not funny.
Yeah.
And just kind of knock out some news and stuff. And
yeah. Some news and then talk about the Pokemon expansion. There are a couple of other new releases that will at least be worth mentioning. But I really haven't been playing too many other new games. Because of Pokemon.
Yeah.
And I'm still playing through all the Mario games. Cause just
Pumpkin Jack game looks interesting.
I haven't seen much of that one.
Yeah. A little hack and slash kind of thing. I may.
Yeah. Report back.
Yeah, really cool.
Cool. That's it. I forgot how to end the show. I don't know what I'm doing anymore.
You say later, and I'll say sayonara.
It's just been too long.
Wes, see if you mix it up.
That's the end. Until next time.
So long.
Sayonara. Thank you.